Shrink Wrap Radio number 32, April 10th, 2006, Healing Through Art.
I'm Jack Ward from the SonicSociety.org, and it's not all in your mind yet. We're back with Shrink Wrap Radio and Dr. Dave.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Well, I was abused by a family member when I was 8 years old, and this went on for a few years up until sort of my early sort of prepubescence. Oh. You know, I guess like, you know, many survivors of abuse, you know, I kind of sublimated it for many years and didn't address it. And you know, my family members also sort of, it was never explicitly spoken about.
Those are the words of Jennifer Linton, a successful artist living in Toronto, Canada. Jennifer is also a wife and a mother, as well as a regular listener to Shrink Wrap Radio. She's also an incest survivor. Through her work in the fine arts, Jennifer has found a way to process the anger, pain, guilt, humiliation, and betrayal that are the inevitable result of such early childhood abuse. And Jennifer is also courageous enough to share her story with us in this interview. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Thanks for having me.
Yay, it's great to have you here. Let me give our audience a quick recap of how you got here. You're kind of like Alice stepping through the looking glass because you were a listener who wrote that you'd like me to book an art therapist as a guest. And you said you were interested in this because you're an artist who uses your art to work through a history of childhood sexual abuse. So old Dr. Dave turned the tables on you and suggested that you be a guest, and you graciously agreed.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah. In listening to your program, I felt that there were a lot of parallels in some of the, say, the dream work and the, when you were talking about archetypes, parallels in that with the what I was doing just natively through my own artwork, and I found that to be, you know, particularly interesting.
Yeah, and that's really true. You know, I do intend to follow your suggestion and to get one or more art therapists on the show. But I thought, you know, it would be great to speak to you who's not an art therapist, but I'm not sure if it's fair to say you've stumbled onto you've stumbled onto something great about the therapeutic potential of art. But let's back up a little, so that everybody's kind of on board with your story. And I know you don't want to go into explicit details, but tell us what you feel comfortable with about the sexual abuse that happened in your childhood.
Well, I was abused by a family member when I was 8 years old. And this went on for a few years up until sort of my early, sort of prepubescence. Okay. You know, I guess like, you know, many survivors of abuse, you know, I kind of sublimated it for many years and didn't address it. And you know, my family members also sort of, it was never explicitly spoken about, but there was sort of, I think, an implied understanding that there was something that was wrong.
So it was kind of like the elephant in the room that nobody would talk about?
I think that's an excellent analogy that, you know, as in, I think, you know, many families and cultures, you know, people don't like to address the things that are difficult to look at, because then it suggests you have a problem. And then when you acknowledge you have a problem, then you actually have to do something about it.
Right. So, and also a child, you know, doesn't have the cognitive skills to exactly know how to deal with it, you know? What kind of framework to put it in and so on. I'm wondering if, you know, in retrospect, if you have any feelings that your parents, by being in denial, that they didn't protect
Yes, I mean, I do feel that way. I certainly did feel that way. And, you know, I mean, the reasons for that, who knows? I mean, you know, without having a very open conversation with them, you know, one will never know why they made the choices that they did make. You know, that being said, I don't blame them. One doesn't want to, I don't want to go through life carrying the baggage of, you know, my parents did this or didn't do this, and therefore, you know.
Sure, I understand.
I'm screwed up.
Yeah, yeah. I understand that. Is having an open conversation with them still an option? Are they still alive?
They're both still alive. My father's quite ill, however, and they're both in their sort of mid-70s. And I think my father has a history. I don't think of sexual abuse as far as I know, but I know that his childhood was not a happy one. Mm-hmm. And I think he has some issues that he needs to address. And, you know, I think because he's sort of in the twilight of his years, I hesitate to bring up the subject matter.
Yeah, I
with
understand.
Him.
So,
yeah.
So what was the impact of the event on your subsequent growing up and development? I mean, you say it started at 8, it went on for several years. So, you know, you're starting to be a preteen, 11, 12, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the impact as you look back now?
Well, I think I was very angry, you know, and I continue to have sort of anger management issues. And certainly in it, around that time in my preteens and teenage years, I was kind of a wild kid, you know, didn't do particularly well in school and had a problem with authority figures in particular. Still do, actually, but, you know, ran with a kind of a wild group of kids and drank a lot and took drugs and, you know, certainly... you know, had kind of a precocious sexuality, which I think in retrospect, I'm not sure that I would have had, you know, not having had the experiences that I did have. But.
Yeah, that often goes, you know, that precocious sexuality often goes along with early childhood abuse. You know, it seems like it can go to one extreme or the other.
Yes.
And I take it you didn't seek out or receive any counseling or therapy.
No, I never have officially sought out therapy. You know, probably in retrospect, I think I might have been further along than, you know, being in my sort of later 30s. And, you know, although I would say I'm much more healed now than perhaps I would have been otherwise had I not had the outlet of my artwork. But I've never gone into therapy.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a somewhat of a confirmed Jungian, I'm of the belief that there is this part of us that is always seeking healing and working on our healing and looking for tools so that we can come into balance. And it sounds like those processes really have been at work within you, and that I know you've studied mythology, and your combination of your involvement with mythology and with art seems to have helped to potentiate that healing, if you were, if you will.
Well, and it's interesting that when I was in art school and then probably for the few years after my graduation, my work was fairly, I guess you would say, impersonal. It was certainly very much informed by a more academic discussion of gender roles and feminism and things like that. And it wasn't until 99, 2000 that my work became personal. And I began using childhood photographs of myself, but then inserting them in these stories, these legends that I was familiar of from classical mythology. Mm-hmm. And of course, these stories serve as basically a vessel, you know, a sort of a ready-made into which I can pour my own history, you know, and depersonalize to some extent the content to make it a little easier to deal with, because I think it's so raw that you almost need to take a step or two back. And by using these stories, I can sort of displace myself in, say, for instance, the story of Persephone. And then from there, go onwards and, you know, push it maybe into more personal spaces once I'm more comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. I'll want to hear more about your use of, bless you. Sounds like you're sneezing on that end.
Yeah, I think I've got a bit of a cold.
I want to hear more about Persephone and how you've used that myth. But before we get into that, still sort of dwelling on your past here. Did it create problems for you, the early abuse, as you came into your adult sexuality? Was it hard for you to move into a trusting relationship or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, I mean, there's always, I think, going to be issues of trust. And, you know, I mean, I think my natural tendency in life is tends towards pessimism, and sort of tending to expect the worst of people and you know, being somewhat suspicious of hidden agendas. And,
well, not surprising, you know, given that your trust was violated.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, so I think that, you know, pretty much is the usual. But, you know, I have, you know, been in a number of fairly long-term monogamous relationships, and I now have been married for a number of years now. And yeah, I mean, I think it must be very difficult, you know, for the partners of people who have, you know, gone through this early trauma. One has to be, I think, very patient. I think with sort of the right partner, you know, certainly, you know, everything works out.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another thing that I'm curious about is reportedly some people recover memories of abuse that have been repressed. Did you ever forget about the sexual abuse or any pieces of it that you had experienced?
There are elements sort of from that period of time, I think, where my memory seems somewhat hazy. And, you know, there are certain incidents that I recall that I'm not entirely certain whether it was an actual event or if it was a fantasy that I had. For instance, I have this, I think, memory of finally confronting my abuser and sort of giving them a shove down a couple steps on these stairs in my house. And I swear this happened, but in retrospect, it almost seems a little too good to be true that actually happened. I mean, I did eventually, as sort of a preteen, become a bit scrappy and a bit of a fighter, I think, as a result of the abuse. You know, one looks around and realizes that the only help that's coming is going to be from yourself. So, you know, if there's one good thing that's come out of this, I'm a fairly, I don't know if you'd say thick-skinned, but, you know, I think I'm a fairly strong individual because, you know, you have to be.
Yeah, and certainly that's how you come across. Now,
well, thank you.
Now, you grew up in a family where, you know, and it makes sense, we couldn't talk about this, we didn't talk about it. But at what point did you decide to come out and to be more public? Because here we are talking about it.
Yeah. Well, it was with my series called The Bitter Seed. I mean, it might have been possible to have exhibited that work and not have mentioned my own history. And people would have, you know, come to the work with their own sort of baggage and history and knowledge and taken from it what they would have and gone away. But to me, it was very important that the body of work had a certain reading. And I think that series is richer from knowing my own biography, as is in the case with a lot of other artists who do, like, say, Frida Kahlo, very autobiographical work that somehow their own personal stories enrich the work and give the viewer a certain insight into it. So with the bitter seed, there was, I mean, some of the works certainly divorced from the larger body may be sort of misinterpreted as just always, isn't that a nice little drawing of a little girl? But certainly when you see the group together, there's a sinister component to it that I think is unavoidable. And I wanted people to know where that was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been to your website, and I'll put a link to your website in the show notes as well. I looked at the links to your paintings, and certainly knowing the backstory helps to make those, you know, to know how to read them. So yeah. I've looked at the paintings and drawings and some of the interviews you've given. Clearly, you're an accomplished fine artist at this point in your life. And so it sounds like gradually you moved away from art that was sort of coming from the head, if you will, into art that was coming more from your heart, more from your soul.
And I think it's certainly the better for it.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly there are, you could still argue there are academic components to the work. I mean, in that I reference classical mythology, and there's also a lot of biblical references. You know, I mean, I have a degree in art history, you know, Western art history. So I often reference previous paintings, stories that if you're familiar with art history and with just basically the culture of Western Europe, you would be familiar with what I'm doing. But I inject my own personal story, which I think makes them a little more interesting.
Right. Now, somehow your story is you've kind of discovered yourself in the archetype of Persephone, and mm-hmm. the two stories kind of are woven together for you. Maybe mm-hmm. you can give us a recap of that Greek myth.
Mm-hmm. Persephone is the daughter of the Greek goddess of agriculture named Demeter. And her story is that one day she was abducted by the Greek god of the underworld. His name is Hades, which is also the name of the underworld. He basically takes her away to be his bride. And her mother doesn't know where she's disappeared to and is searching the earth and the cosmos for her daughter. In the meantime, of course, the earth, the crops fail, and you know, all sorts of ecological disasters take place because she's not doing her job. And eventually it is revealed that she is with Hades. And so what ends up happening is Zeus, who's basically the king of all the gods, makes a judgment and says that Persephone has to remain in Hades for a third of the year because she ate a seed from a pomegranate. And there's sort of this rule that if you eat food while you're in the underworld, you have to stay there. So they strike a bargain and say for a third of the year, she stays in the underworld, which is like the Greek afterlife. They don't really have heaven and hell. They just kind of have one place. And then the rest of the time, she's above the surface. And so it's spring and summer, and then, of course, fall. Her mother anticipates her leaving and things start to die. So it's basically a Greek myth that, you know, on the surface tells a story to explain the changing of the seasons. And it's also that very kind of archetypal death and rebirth story in that annually, you know, you could say that Persephone descends into the underworld and dies, you know, like you could even make a parallel to, of course, Christ, you know, and all sorts of other legends, you know, that yes. There's this annual sacrifice and then she always comes back from the dead. And this is just this annual cycle. So I kind of saw myself as Persephone, as this kind of basically sacrifice. And of course, Persephone is abducted, you know, essentially raped. The whole series began with a photo of myself as a young child holding a piece of fruit. And I made this piece of fruit a pomegranate. And, of course, the pomegranate is central to this story. So, and this is a symbol that I've used to this day, you know, throughout my work. That was kind of the impetus for that. And then, you know, the idea, of course, of descending into the underworld, you know, harkens back to, you know, if you want to tie it into Jungian psychology, the idea of going into one's subconscious, mm-hmm. looking into the dark places where we don't want to look and
precisely.
Confronting them with the hope, I guess, of being reborn, you know, of working through those dark places and coming out the other end.
Yes. Yes, and it sounds like that's the process that you are immersed in.
Well, you know, that's what I'm hoping anyway. You know, and so that was kind of what I was working at with that series.
Yeah.
And then a couple years later, I went on to do, after that series, I went on to do a series of work that dealt with more like animals and animal rights. I needed a break from the very personal stuff. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, I kind of revisited my same history. But this time around, as an adult, and I slipped myself into the role of Saint Ursula, who's sort of a fringe saint in the Catholic sort of hagiography or whatever. She's the patron saint and protector of schoolgirls. So, you know, I show myself dressed as like a Catholic schoolgirl with a kilt, mm-hmm. and I've got angel wings and a sword, and basically I kind of worked through the series being the protector that I guess I wanted mm-hmm. as a child but didn't mm-hmm. have. There's you know, one image in particular where there's a double self-portrait of myself as a child and myself as an adult sort of counseling my younger self. And it's this kind of imagined, fantasy-driven encounters, you know. And so, again, I'm sort of using this for the fringe saint, you know, but essentially, again, doing this very personal work.
Yeah, but it's really interesting that you took this 2 year break. Before mm-hmm. the break, your work really, I think, was focusing on unearthing the victim and, mm-hmm. you know, and really, identifying with and being in touch with the pain of being a victim and trying to give that some expression. And then there's this two-year hiatus, and it comes back to you, but now you're in the role of protector and mm-hmm. giving some protection and nurturing to that inner child.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting that this, you know, it sounds like a spontaneous healing process. Do you have any... Have you noticed changes in your psyche and your sense of well-being over time? Do you have a sense of being in a healing process?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, in my teens and 20s, I was just generally kind of an angry person. And, you know, even though I was in a committed relationship and was married in my 20s, you know, I think I still had to really work through some issues that I had about men, you know, mm-hmm. about my relationship with my parents, my relationship with just people in general. And I would say, you know, I mean, of course, I'm older now, but and now I'm a parent. So I would say generally I'm a happier person than I used to be. And, you know, let's hope a more sort of emotionally mature person. And, you know, and I'm not willing to just place the blame at the feet of others. I'm certainly not suggesting that I'm to blame for this, but you know, there does come a point where you just have to let that go. And I'm hoping that that's kind of, you know, what I worked through and probably continue to work through mm-hmm. with my own work. You know, often my work is sort of where I put all of my angst, you know, so sometimes, you know, you could look at my body work and say, oh, wow, there's a lot going on there that's maybe on the negative side. But I think it's just, that tends to be what goes into my artwork. Although, you know, my newer work now is really more a reflection of my role as being a mother and that imagery. Well, I guess because I've got my little guy in them, I you know, they're a little bit happier.
Yeah, well, and as you point out, you know, we go into the dark places and we go down into the underworld, hopefully to come back and to mm-hmm. emerge out of that darkness into the light. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so you've gone into your darkness a lot. Mm-hmm. You may be going in some more, but there's some light.
Well, it's a lifelong thing, but sure. Yeah, I mean, one doesn't need to dwell, and one shouldn't dwell in the darkness for too long, because it, you know, tends to mess up your head. And I don't think it's a very healthy place to be.
Yeah. You know? And that reminds me of the myth, as you told it. It was an annual rite, suggesting that mm-hmm. periodically one is called to go back down.
Yeah.
Sometimes kicking and screaming.
Oh, sure. You know, yeah. Because, you know, we don't often want to look at the dark stuff. You know,
right.
I mean, it's easier, I suppose, to distract oneself with, you know, other nonsense in your life. But, you know, I think every now and then maybe it's good to check in and see how your soul's doing. I don't
mm-hmm.
know.
mm-hmm. Sexual abuse of children is far more prevalent than used to be believed. I mean, shockingly so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's likely that one or more listeners have themselves been victims at some point or another. Is there any advice you would have for them?
I would say, you know, don't wait too long to maybe seek out, I mean, professional help, I guess, if they're comfortable with that. I mean, certainly, I would say seek out some kind of counsel. I mean, at least, you know, if you spoke to a friend about it, it's, I think, better to at least, you know, exercise your demons to some degree rather than letting it fester,
mm-hmm.
you know, inside. And,
right.
you know, so that would probably be the best recourse, because, you know, if you do walk around with that inside, it's going to come out, you know, and if it's not addressed, you know, maybe in a creative manner, then it's probably going to come out in a destructive manner. And I've seen it in people who've had, you know, issues, not necessarily even of sexual abuse, but just people who have, you know, some baggage they need to deal with. And, you know, if they don't deal with it in a positive way, you know, they quite often end up alcoholics or drug addicts or, you know,
right.
God knows what.
Right. Well, that sounds like wise advice to me. Well, mm-hmm. to wrap things up here, I had made reference to your website and said I would put it in the show notes, but not everybody makes it to the website, unfortunately. Why don't you go ahead and give us the address of your website?
Okay. Well, it's easy to find. It's www.jenniferlinton, and that's JenniferLinton.ca. That's .ca because I'm in Canada. A lot of people say .com, but that's another Jennifer Linton.
Oh, okay. So make sure you say .ca.
Yeah.
so that you get to the famous artist in Toronto. And Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for your willingness to be on the show and to share your experience and the wisdom that's come out of it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's our interview with Toronto artist Jennifer Linton. I admire her courage in being willing to share her story with us. And I hope you take some inspiration from her account to face some of your own inner demons. We all have them. For me, Jennifer's account underscores the value of using what Jungians refer to as active imagination in working toward healing and wholeness. The idea is that by combining imagination and expression, whether that expression be through journaling, poetry, movement, collage, painting, or other forms of artistic expression, we are able to give voice to those dissociated parts of ourselves which need to become better integrated into our working personality. Clearly, Jennifer's artwork serves as a vehicle for her to revisit painful places and to reprocess them in ways that are expressive and sometimes playful or whimsical. She's able to give voice to what could not be spoken as a child. I'm also struck by Jennifer's use of the Greek myth of Persephone. By identifying with Persephone, she's able to step outside the pain of her own story and see it in the context of a larger, timeless, archetypal story. It's still a tragic story in some respects, but it also is a heroic one. When we find ourselves in a mythic pattern, it can give us a sense of larger meaning to our lives. We come to see our own particular pains as challenges to grow and persevere in a larger, timeless, heroic quest. If you've been following the series, you'll recall my recent interview with Dr. Alberto Violdo on shamanic healing. I've been reading his most recent book. He emphasizes there that the South American shaman with whom he has studied don't make the sharp distinction that we do between inner and outer, real and imaginary. For them, working in the imaginal sphere is working on reality, and it's in that imaginal sphere that they do their healing work. As Alberto Violdo says in the introduction to his book, the shaman believe that the physical world rests within the realm of the mind, which rests within the domain of the soul, which is held within the folds of the spirit. Spirit is the wellspring from which everything else emerges. Change at the level of spirit transforms the world. End quote. For us in the West, mythology and art are two possible pathways to help us enter into this imaginal realm, the realm of psyche, where the real soul work needs to be done. As a member of Podshow, we've been taking part in promoting GoDaddy.com, the leading provider of domain names and web hosting. You will discover three different money-saving codes if you check the left margin of our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. I was able to pass on these savings to my good friend Bert Kaplan, who is my guest on episode number 10. Well, among other things, Bert is an artist, and I had been encouraging him to get a website to display his art. Well, he ended up getting a .Mac account so that he could use the iWeb software that you can get for the Mac. The only problem is his website had a rather long and hard-to-remember .Mac address. So I suggested he go to GoDaddy.com and buy the domain name www.bertkaplan.com. And using the discount, he was able to get bertkaplan.com for only $6.95. Then for no additional charge, he was able to call up the folks at GoDaddy.com and get them to automatically transfer any hits on BertKaplan.com to his .Mac website. You can test it out for yourself if you want by going to BertKaplan.com. That's www.BertKaplan.com. And you can take a look at Bert's art there. And you'll notice that behind the scenes, automatically, you got transferred to his .Mac account. This is just one way you can take advantage of the three different GoDaddy discounts that you'll find on our pages at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, on to the mailbag. First of all, I want to let those of you know, let those of you who recall the interviews with Mohammed in Baghdad know that I have had a recent email exchange with him. And fortunately, he and his family are still safe, and I know you'll join me in gratitude for that and the hope for his continued safety. I did an email exchange with a listener by the name of Kim, who is a teacher in Yuba City. And he writes, I enjoy your podcast immensely, and last night listened to your latest interview with Dr. Stanley Krippner about research into parapsychology. May I suggest a possible interview with Dr. Jessica Utz, a professor of statistics at UC Davis? I've never met or spoken with her, but have read research by her into psychic claims. It's been a while, but if my memory serves me accurately, she found some statistical support for psychic ability through some pretty strenuous testing. I just found out on the Davis website that she's on sabbatical leave at UC Irvine. Anyway, just a suggestion. Who knows? She might be willing to appear on your podcast. Well, Kim, as I wrote to you in an email, I did send off an email to Dr. Utz. I found an article about her research, which indeed she has a very interesting, strong article about statistical research supporting parapsychological findings. And evidently she's been very active in the parapsychological arena, and it's interesting to find somebody with her very excellent credentials has done so much research in this area. Unfortunately, she has yet to answer my email, so I guess the only thing I can do is wait a while longer and then maybe try sending her another email. Kim goes on in his email to say, another suggestion for a show, one about the personality disorders, the Axis II tribe in the DSM. Now, DSM refers to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. So people in other countries, I don't know if you're familiar with that document or not. It's a big fat book that's used to diagnose various kinds of mental disorders. Kim says in his email, at the risk of being presumptuous, I'd sure enjoy hearing you do a scholarly show or interview about them, but one that really explored the topic, what personality disorders are, characteristics testing for them, the effect they have on others, etc. But a real scholarly investigation, one that differentiated, for instance, between OCD, that would be obsessive compulsive disorder, on axis 1 and OCPD on axis 2. I know I'm sounding a bit pretentious, and as you say, a little knowledge can be dangerous, but I find these axis 2 beasts fascinating and horrifically alarming. Well, let you go after all this and keep up the great work and enjoyable program. Well, Kim, I am not a big aficionado of the DSM. Fortunately, I don't need to use it anymore since I'm not doing clinical work now. And even when I was doing clinical work, I used it as little as possible. Now, I could bring on my colleague, Dr. Maria Hess, who was in a previous show and who teaches abnormal psychology and is quite knowledgeable about the DSM. And I did mention it to her, and she would be willing to do that in some future show. So perhaps we'll do it, but I'm not sure how much general interest there is in the DSM. And I communicated some of this back to Kim, and I always like to know as much as I can about my listeners. So I asked him to tell me a little bit about himself and what he's teaching. He had mentioned he was a teacher. So I received another email back from him, and he said, as for what I teach, I've been teaching in so-called alternative ed for 10 years now, otherwise known as the Continuation High School and Independent Study. I have many students, but meet with them one-on-one, which is a delight from many perspectives. I enjoyed the elementary classroom for 19 years before this, so I'm finishing up a grand total of 29 years in public education. Hey, good for you. I teach a wide variety of kids in terms of their reasons for choosing independent study, and an amazing number of students do it, for good and bad. Many of them are extremely bright and accomplished. I try to steer the better students to quite sophisticated literature by Thomas Hardy, Somerset Maugham, Sinclair Lewis, Theodore Dreiser, and I could go on and on. Not many kids will put up with of human bondage, but they're out there. The reason I mention this is that some of the earlier literature of the 19th and early 20th centuries can be very illustrative of the forces that work psychologically upon people. These inexorable forces that cause us to make the decisions we make and often regret. Well-intentioned forces like ambition, love, self-betterment, acquisition of knowledge, etc., etc. Novels like Jude the Obscure, An American Tragedy, and Of Human Bondage, and many others are really psychological novels. At least they speak to me that way and allow me to shake my head and say, "Don't do that, Philip. Stop, Clyde, what are you thinking? And Jude, for heaven's sake, wake up and have some common sense." And then I realized I could have and should have said the same things to myself over the years. Oh well, getting too existentialist here. Anyway, keep up the good work, David. And I like your mixture of rigorous scientific method and yet exploring stuff that doesn't always lend itself necessarily to Carl Sagan-type rationalism. I listen to a lot of podcasts that are skeptical in intent, such as The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Point of Inquiry, Audio Martini, etc. But I also enjoy ones like Out There. Some of the skeptic ones are too serious and don't seem to acknowledge the significance of Jung, etc. And, of course, other podcasts go way overboard and expound on bizarre conspiracy theories. Yours strikes a happy medium. As for the personality disorders, they just fascinate me, and I read clinical stuff on them, clinical narratives, etc., and they can be quite frightening in an eerie way. Let you blessedly go, David, and keep the interviews coming, Kim. Well, Kim, I will keep the interviews coming, and I'm glad that you find that we're striking a happy medium here between the skeptical end and the totally credulous end. And in fact, I always seem to find myself somewhere in the middle between those two extremes. Also, I was interested in your remarks on the relevance of literature psychologically, because my own undergraduate major was in creative writing, and I was devouring novels as an undergraduate. In fact, I was reading more novels than anything else. And to me, it felt like I was doing important work in doing that, even though I was reading novels instead of some of the other reading that was assigned to me. But I felt like I was getting to the kind of the heart, the brass tacks of what it's like to be alive and to be a human being. So I totally agree with you about the importance of that kind of pursuit. This brings us to the close of this week's show. I think you'll find next week's show interesting, especially in light of some of the topics we've been discussing. Recently, there was a major conference at the University of California at Berkeley on scientific research into the impact of spiritual transformation on patients suffering from life-threatening illnesses. Two of my friends were presenters at that conference. They'll share with you here the findings of their four-year longitudinal study. The results were dramatic, so be sure to listen next week. I'm eager to know where you are. So I've just set up a Frapper map on our site. Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. If you aren't familiar with Frapper, it's a web-based utility that allows you to place a little push pin on a world map showing where you live. Even though this is the first time I've announced it on the air, I see that a few people have discovered it on their own. Julianne in London, I was delighted to see you had discovered it. And Rennie in Lausanne, Switzerland, what a pleasant surprise to discover you. Everybody else, please go to the Frapper link on shrinkwrapradio.com and tell us where you are. Or you can go directly to the map by going to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. I noticed there is even a forum on the Frapper site we can use if you so choose. My sister was the first to post a message there. One way or another, I'd love to hear from you. Please send email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Our show notes are at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. Still not getting enough voicemail? It's really easy. You can leave voicemail for ShrinkPod on Skype or Gizmo Project. And we also have a phone in the U.S. where you can leave voicemail. That number is 206-888-2746. Please stay tuned after our closing theme music to hear the PodSafe music selection, I Wonder, by Natalie Brown. Once again, I think Synchronicity has brought me the perfect music for today's interview. Listen closely to the words. Among them you'll hear, "It's amazing what this life can put you through. There's a choice to make in all you do." Go to the show notes to find links to the sensational Natalie Brown. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Is it memories?